Today is Thursday, May 1st, and we will continue with our informational meeting format. We're going to be hearing from Barney. Levity is allowed in this. If you'd like to come to the mics and laugh, I mean, we can put it on the record.
Well, those are the ones we want to hear about.
Yeah. You do not have to convince me that Ruth Shepherd was involved in this. I mean, there's... All right, we'll share after committee. Anyway, we're going to hear from Barney Spate, not quite yet, Barney, on some of the changes we're considering to 3624. We're going to hear from Scott Gallant. Is Scott here yet?
He's out. He's here, yeah.
He's supporting the Oregon Health Plan.
Right.
On medical liability in the malpractice environment, and then OHP reimbursement policies, quantifying the cost to other purchasers, Kevin Earls and the Hospital Association. But before we get into that, I have some very distressing news. I was handed a note that says Jeff Hetherington is going to bake cookies for our committee next week.
Uh-oh.
All week. Where is Hetherington? So
he's working. He's making
to
cookies.
Give him plenty of time to practice. We will not be holding committee next Monday. Just to let everybody know, convenience for your scheduling.
There he is.
The second.
What kind of cookies?
Yeah, we are just acknowledging your generosity with a great deal of trepidation.
I'd like walnuts in it.
Yeah, and I'd like white chocolate.
Yeah.
I would also like you to
hazelnuts.
Notice that Representative Bates is in attendance, and that he has really, truly never looked better. So, any important messages from staff?
No, Chair.
Ms. Chair, do we need prior authorization to add walnuts to those cookies? That's just a thought.
We can put it in the bill.
All
right. With that, let me call Barney to the stand to talk about some of the changes we've been discussing. And again, compliment Mr. Spate for his tireless and endless hours that he has put into this project. We appreciate you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. I'd like to say that many people have put a lot of work into the efforts so far, and I think we'll continue to do so. I think my purpose today, or what I'm prepared to talk about today, is since the bill 3624 was printed, there have been a series of meetings with interested parties, primarily the Oregon Medical Association, representatives of the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, two representatives of the fully capitated health plans, two or three representatives of this committee, one meeting that included Lynn Reed from the Office of Medical Assistance Program and Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. And what I'd like to do is just speak conceptually of some of the modifications, proposed modifications or alternatives that are being discussed. They're still working on crafting legislative, actual legislative language for your consideration at some point in the future in LC. Let me begin with Section 1 of the bill, and I believe that Mr. Berkobian has laid in front of you the bulleted summary of the bill, and I'm just going to give you some thoughts about what we're trying to achieve through these discussions in each of the sections that we dealt with, and we did not deal with all of them. Section 1, if you recall the intent of Section 1, and I think there's very broad support of it from everybody I've talked to, is to have a fairly strong policy statement that managed care will be used wherever, in fact, it can be used. The bill is crafted in its printed form in such a way as to primarily refer to health services or the fully capitated health plans serving, providing health services. We've really broadened that concept to say whether it's medical services, dental services, or mental health services, to the extent that managed care is available, it is a priority. And we do that in the following way. One would be a simple declarative statement saying every eligible applicant will be enrolled. That would be the policy statement. And then a second paragraph of that section would then say there are certain exceptions to that policy statement. And the three broad areas that have been discussed include the exception in which there is no managed care in a particular designated area. For example, there are counties in the state that do not have fully capitated health plans serving those. So in those situations, fee-for-service delivery systems would be the default. The second would be in those areas of the state in which there are fully capitated health plans and other managed care service organizations like MHOs and DCOs, but they do not have the capacity to accept additional applicants. And in that situation, then the backup would be that fee-for-service would be utilized. And then the third exception doesn't relate so much to the concepts of the plans themselves, but more if an applicant qualifies for an exemption from enrollment into a fully capitated health plan or other managed care system. And I believe, if you recall, that Ms. Reed, in her testimony, provided the committee with a list of, if you will, exemption criteria that are currently being used, and there's a fair degree of discussion about each of those. Some of them could be optional based upon the desires of the applicant. Others would be probably more appropriate as mandatory. But these will attempted to be iterated in a proposed statute. And then probably there would be other enrollment exceptions that might develop that could be promulgated by administrative rule. The sum and substance of these discussions and what I've just told you is just, I think, a further clarification of the kind of the foundational purpose of Section 1, and that is a very strong policy commitment to managed care, and then some very explicit situations in which that policy commitment would be held in abeyance. I'll stop at the end of each section if you'd like to ask questions. The last comment I'd make about Section 1 is that we have used terms, for example, capacity to serve additional applicants, and so we've been working through how do you actually define that, and the general consensus that I recall is to look to some recently adopted Balanced Budget Act amendments out of the federal government that lay out some standards for managed care, and those will be incorporated at least conceptually into the definition. That's Section 1. No remarkable changes, but I think very sound clarifications of intent and exceptions that I will give you my interpretation. I think people are comfortable with the direction that the discussion is going on that section.
And talk, if you would, just a little bit, Barney, about trying to clarify the conflicting statutory requirements that we will reimburse at full cost and we will reimburse at a reasonable cost. I think that's part of what we're trying to get at in Section 1. And
Mr. Chair, could I defer that to when I get down to Section 8?
That'd be fine.
Because that's the order we kind of took it in. And
okay.
And I'll just, with your indulgence, I'll move forward that way. Section 2, there's really, and the bill does two things. One is substantial, I think, in a policy statement. It, as your handout indicates, it eliminates the requirement that providers be reimbursed at rates that cover the cost of services. And this is what I think Chair Westland was referring to, and we actually handle this issue in an alternative conceptual way later. But the work group to date, there's no change in Section 2 on that point. We did offer some different language to articulate that fee-for-service would be a backup to primary care. And it's primarily to find different ways to describe the concept of backup, because there are going to be state areas of the state in which managed care may not be there, and we were looking for better terminology. No substantive changes there, primarily ones of language. Section 4 and 5, if you recall in the bill, deal with physician care organizations and what the concepts that have been discussed is really to merge the two sections together into a section that does the following thing. First of all, it would define what a physician care organization is, and that would be primarily a definition that's driven off of a series of either required medical services that would have to be included under a PCO contract, or some optional medical services that at the option of both the PCO and the department could be included. But the intent remains, as in the current bill, that inpatient hospital would not be one of those covered services. So there's a definition of a PCO as far as what the entity does. Then the second concept would be that the department is authorized to contract with PCOs. And the major change that we discussed in these and these alternatives would be that they could contract in certain circumstances. And the statute would be explicit relative to the circumstances in which the department could contract with a PCO. The first circumstance would be what is affectionately known, or perhaps not affectionately known by some, as the Kaiser circumstance. The second would be where
speech folly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, I'll reserve the right to judge that
later. That's
yeah. The second circumstance where a PCO would be authorized would be in a designated area that is currently not being served by a fully capitated health plan. So there are counties in the state where FCHPs are not operating, this would offer a managed care alternative of the PCO in those areas. However, there's a conceptual provision to that, and that is that the department should seek from the FCHPs that with whom it has contracts to see if they would want to go into those areas. And so it's trying to encourage the expansion of the FCHPs, but in the absence of such expansion, the PCO would be an alternative that would be authorized. The last two circumstances relate to what I call the conversion circumstances, and both of them relate to when a fully capitated health plan that currently has a contract with the state, they could under certain circumstances convert to a PCO. The first incident would be if the fully capitated health plan is the only plan serving an area, then conceptually, what we've said is they merely have to meet certain requirements that the department would lay out, or that would be the requirements for conversion that the Office of Health Policy and Research would develop. Because it's basically they're the only FCHP in the area, and if they have substantive and defensible reasons for the conversion and the state agrees with that, then they should be able to convert, because, again, it keeps a form of managed care in that area. We then discuss the situation where there are multiple FCHPs in a designated area, and perhaps one of them would like to convert. And the concern that we're trying to address is that we do not want to create a market situation in a given area where FCHPs, those who do not want to convert, could be harmed over the long haul economically or in retention of providers or attraction of new eligibles. And so we've talked about really kind of a two-step or three-step approach, and one would be that this could only happen when the FCHPs that are the other FCHPs in this area do not have the capacity to serve additional applicants. That is, if you will, they're at their maximum capacity, and there's probably not a reasonable near or intermediate term that they're going to be able to expand that capacity. In addition to that, there would have to be a determination made by the Office of Health Policy and Research that a conversion of a FCHP to a PCO would not threaten the financial viability of the remaining fully capitated health plans. What we're trying to do is set the bar high enough, appropriately high enough, so that extant FCHPs are not threatened over the long haul, but that we could introduce an alternative PCO model where it's appropriate, and finally they'd have to meet other requirements of conversion. So what we've done with those steps in the PCO is to define what it is, authorize in a permissive sense the department to contract with such an entity, and then to try to be very carefully and explicitly say what are the circumstances under which those can be used. And again, it's done for the I think policy purpose is that the first line desires to make sure that we keep healthy FCHPs in the Oregon Health Plan, serving Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries. The other concepts of this section, that the department may accept financial contributions and seek federal match, stay in place. So that's sections 4 and 5. We did not deal with, the work group that I participated in did not deal with section 6. This section, as you recall, deals with FCHPs performing certain administrative services management activities in the fee-for-service. And one of the reasons is we basically thought that that's probably a discussion more appropriate for the FCHPs and OMAP and others to have. While it's of interest to everybody on the committee, it was of a secondary interest, and we wanted to move through the issues that were of primary interest. In Section 7 is not on your list, Mr. Berkobian. Section 7, there was a conceptual addition that came from the Office of Health Policy and Research, and it's basically adds some language to the role of the Health Services Commission to permit them to consider the effectiveness and cost-effectiveness of healthcare services and to use international sources of peer-reviewed journals as the basis of making such evaluations. So there will be, I think, in a future LC draft, that language for your consideration. Probably the most extensive work and discussion dealt with what I would call as an alternative to Section 8. And in concept, we would delete the current Section 8 and would replace it with a fairly long section that does the following things. First, it would state a legislative intent, and we know that I think we all are realistic about what legislative intents are, but I think all of us participating, FCHPs, medical providers, institutional health care providers, believe that it's important that the legislature state its intent
intends to reimburse
Oregon Health Plan providers on the basis of cost, and then what we try to do is to lay out what I have described as the creation of a benchmark cost standard that would be developed by an actuary working with the Health Services Commission, so that all parties to the Oregon Health Plan and the Legislative Assembly and the Executive Branch would, through this benchmark, understand the difference between actual appropriation and funding for the Oregon Health Plan by provider category compared to what would be a reasonable benchmark. And we're still working on what the basis of that reasonable benchmark would be, but let me give you an example, and there are other examples that we can discuss if you'd like. Primarily looking at if Medicare, for example, for hospitals using Medicare cost reports for the reasonableness of the level of reimbursement for hospital services, for physicians using what's known as the RBRVS conversion factor for Medicare for physicians,
for durable medical equipment or, and supplies, some percentage of Medicare allowable costs. But you get the idea of trying to create by service category or by provider category a benchmark that would say, hypothetically, for example, that a report would be delivered that if the Oregon Health Plan serving the enrollees that it's serving was reimbursing using these reimbursement benchmarks, the per capita cost would be X. And that X then becomes a standard against which future the governor's balanced budget, the department's appropriation request, and ultimately the final appropriation approved by the legislature could be compared. And it gives all of us an idea of, if you will, and I think a defensive, objective idea of the adequacy of reimbursement relative to an external and objective source. There's going to have to be continued discussion of how to do this, but what we envision is the benchmark is created. The Health Services Commission reports that benchmark, and it's part of its reporting requirements. Currently, with the prioritized list on or about something like July 1 before in an even numbered year. That report then could be used by the governor and the executive branch in the development of its budget. But then when the budget was finally turned over to the legislature, usually in December, January of just before a session, there would be a report required of the Department of Human Services comparing its proposed budget with this benchmark and indicating if there is a difference, and most likely there would be, given the 25 years experience I've had with Medicaid, there would probably always be less than, but it would allow for a disclosure of what the difference is from the benchmark and the underlying reasons for such a variance. What this concept, and I know it's probably, I've been long-winded about it, what this concept does, I think in a policy sense, is create an acceptable alternative to the striking language in Section 2 where we eliminate the requirement that providers be reimbursed at rates that cover cost. This benchmark would then become an alternative to that, since that language has been stricken or would be stricken in this bill. And we think, I don't want to speak for anybody that's been party to it, but I think I've seen very strong support for the creation of something like this because we think it would be useful. And not to belabor the point too much, but in a way it's somewhat in healthcare like the Quality Education Act approach was. But as I think it was Representative Cruz noted, perhaps one step better than that because the benchmark would actually be an external factor like Medicare that would be comparing to. But again, I think it's helpful in for all of us in the appropriations process to understand what the appropriations are relative to a benchmark like Medicare cost or some other benchmark.
Would the committee like Barney to outline this on a whiteboard? I'll take that as a no.
Mr. Chairman, you do allude to a fact that, I'm going to just anticipate what you might like me to comment on briefly, and that is that there is a belief that with such a benchmark, we could move from the benchmark to an approach of looking at appropriations for the Oregon Health Plan, both for those in managed care and the fee-for-service component of that budget, looking at it on some proportionality basis. And the concept has been that if in this benchmark total physician services account for about 25% of the cost of the benchmark or the anticipated projected per capita cost, then that proportionality of 25% could be carried over into an appropriation process that even if the appropriation is less than the benchmark, and it probably normally would be, there would be at least some proportionality of funding into the physician services category. Similarly with hospital, durable medical equipment, et cetera. We we have had, I think, fairly what I would characterize as wide-ranging and positive discussions with the concept. There are a slew, that's a technical term, a slew of technical issues that have to be worked on. I think this discussion will continue, and I believe that Dr. Goldberg from the Office of Health Policy and Research may help us in that regard. But it does offer an interesting look or approach to the appropriations and building. I think what providers are looking for is a process sense of equity. And I'll stop there because there may be a question.
That's a question that I see Representative Greenlight getting ready to ask.
Yeah, the question I was going to ask is about this proportionality thing. And one of the problems the difficulty of continuing to fund health care has been changes in proportionality, one segment growing faster than another segment. And I'm not sure whether the proportionality rewards that or, you know, I think I remember half of the total increase in 1 year being an increase in the cost of drugs, say, prescription drugs. So the proportionality doesn't seem to me to be, I mean, it seems to reward that rather than to pinch that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlight, in fact, the situation you point out is one of the kind of intellectual quandaries that we have to work through, because I think what many would look back on the last couple of biennia and say that there have been what many people would call substantial funding increases to the Oregon Health Plan, excuse me, but much of it had to go to increased pharmaceutical costs. And how we would do this, I mean, clearly you could create through the appropriations process and even rate setting for the FCHPs, you could create this. Does it have the underlying equity? Because I think what other providers would say is we need to have some kind of global budget control within each of these categories. Otherwise, we're not going to solve the equity issue. And we're still talking about how would that happen? How would you get that kind of control so that you don't create the perverse incentive that you allude to?
I wonder if I could follow up with, go off in a slightly different direction. As you were talking, I was thinking about the QEM and the constitutional amendment to fund, to determine what a quality education is and to talk about that components and then to talk about the extent to which you're not, you know, the QEM goes to $6.9 billion for K-12, and we're proposing $5.05 billion, and okay, we have a standard, we have a benchmark, and we have a pot of money. And it also took me back to this, one of the original notions of the Oregon Health Plan, that you would fund, you would have a certain amount of money, and you'd move up the scale until you got to that amount of money, which is a with the assumption everybody would be paid in full for what they did. And not talking about the actuarial estimates of this, it seems to me that doesn't do this anymore. It says, well, we have a certain relative proportion of funding. If the requirements go up and or the budget goes down, unfortunately, sometimes happen both at the same time, which is a real problem. Now we'll simply just try and figure out how to proportionally spend the money we have rather than changing the target by saying, okay, how far up some list do we have to go to get back to where we were? So you were involved in some of those early discussions. This really does move it in a very, very different direction, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlight, I would concur that it does move it in a dramatically different direction. I think many of us from all provider sectors understand that this would be a significant change from those earlier policy principles. There's a sober sense of pragmatism that we're dealing with compared to the late 80s and early 90s, both relative to the rate of growth of healthcare costs and government's ability to stay current in that, and also the underlying stresses on state government generally because of the nature of the economy. That said, and it's with disappointment, I think all of us don't really like to see the striking of the words in Section 2. Some would say, not necessarily with cynicism, but with sadness, well, except for perhaps a couple of years of the Oregon Health Plan experience, that's only been honored in the breach anyway.
We never really had the flexibility to move the line.
The other thing we have seen, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, is that we have moved the line. We have changed benefits. All of the work of creating the standard population was all of that. But I also think we have a new realism that there are limits to even the ability to move the line or change benefit schedules to be able to meet the other goal, which is reasonable reimbursement based on, you know, cost. So in facing that dilemma, in facing the reality of that, I'll speak for myself and not necessarily others. I think what is important is then to have a benchmark so that we can describe how far from some reasonableness test are we.
That is the QEM model.
And it creates a bully pulpit for all of us, both providers, advocates for clients and others, to be able to try to, in a sober and objective way, say this is how far short we are. And we know that, you know, that we in the healthcare sector, human services sector, compete with the other priorities of government when we come in here. But I think it's important for us to at least have a yardstick to be able to describe to all of you what the reality is that we all see. And that is an alternative to the if you will, current policy framework.
And I would cite what I think is a significant difference between the QEM model and what we're discussing. And let me emphasize, this is only in the discussion phase, but in that the yardstick, the measurement against which, you know, you gauge how well, in this case, you are funding, are outside objective measurements. They aren't self-generated from within by what I would classify, not this necessarily a bad thing, you know, a group of advocates. We're talking about Medicare rates, and we're trying to find one for pharmaceuticals. But I think that's a significant difference.
Which one was the independent outside?
Medicare. That's what those rates would be based on.
The Medicare rates per service rendered.
Yeah, the RVU, DRG.
But the utilization pattern's not independent. The utilization pattern's how it defines or how there are some projections.
But the cost per unit.
Cost per unit is calculated some way. It's the
right.
Units that are measured.
And we would assume, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, we would assume that in the development of this, what I've described as
shared pain model,
projected per capita expenditures using cost, Medicare cost, for example, as a basis, would in fact use actual or estimates of OHP enrollment encounter data, so that we try to get to an actuarially fair and balanced approach of what would it cost to fund the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid if the state were paying on a different basis. And there's, quite candidly, if you talk about Medicare, not many of the providers I know jump up and down and say, Medicare's a great payer. It's a better payer than most state Medicaid programs, and it can be, at least for the legislature, that independent third party, and I suppose we'd all say if the state could ever pay 80, 85, 90% of Medicare, we would all be very happy. The last section that we dealt with...
I believe Representative Marsh...
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
One of the dangers in this yardstick is that if you are locking in proportional pieces of that yardstick, which it almost sounded like you were doing, like we were getting to the point of almost turf. And we heard one of the health plan folks come in and say that one of their ways of managing, they were able to save money on drugs and pharmaceuticals and reimburse doctors better. And I don't want to lose sight of that management by the fully capitated health plans for the sake of us locking men to some yardstick here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, you are correct about that, and I'd like to, again, try to describe the conceptual conversation is, I think the benchmark plays an interesting role in both policy setting and appropriation. The discussions about the proportionality, which we have not addressed in any specific language, but we've had discussions about, has probably its most applicability in the appropriations process in this building. I don't believe, for the reasons you cited, that it would be appropriate from the state's contract relationships with an FCHP, because I think we do want to incentivize change in utilization where it's medically appropriate, change in expenditure patterns where it's medically appropriate, and so that we haven't gotten to that point. I don't think, I think we all we've gotten to is we realize there are probably two or three phases to this process, and this concept may have real limitations in the end phases for the reasons you cited. That's why it's going to take, I think, a lot more discussion.
Okay, thank you.
The last section we dealt with, it was section 14, and what we've proposed is merely to make it more explicit that the intent of section 14 was, in fact, to use the prioritized list, to seek federal approval, to use the prioritized list in whatever form approved by CMS, if you will, lay on top of the Medicaid minimum services, and then with the savings that would be generated by that, the rationale I think that's been in all of the work groups and discussed before this committee before was those savings of the list on the mandatory services would generate funds that could then be used to buy optional services like prescription drug, mental health coverage, CD, et cetera. And so we merely talked about making that much more explicit. What we did not talk about, I indicated that we didn't talk about Section 6, which relates to the management of fee-for-service or the management activities by FCHPs. We did not talk about any of the PBM kinds of issues. Probably a slightly different group of stakeholders need to be involved in that. And we did not talk about Section 10, which relates to various reimbursement and admission policies regarding hospitals. Primarily the reason I told you that many of the sections we didn't address because they really probably call for a different venue or a different group of stakeholders. Section 10 I would characterize as contentious, and we wanted to put our early efforts into those sections where we could find both consensus on concepts and perhaps even move farther in consensus on words. And so I think we're at a point as of the most recent meeting of last night to be able to, in not too many days, to have a work product to look at to see how everyone reacts to that. Mr. Chair, that's the sum and substance of my comments this afternoon.
That's what we've been doing. Any questions?
Yeah, can I go back to that contentious Section 10 and the question about requiring hospitals to treat fully capitated health care patients? Would that require hospitals, that is what that said, right? No, eligible, sort of talks about declining an FCHP client. Would that prohibit them from declining a client for any service?
mean, if an FCHP client showed up at Kaiser Sunnyside for a transplant or something, would that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlink, I don't feel comfortable going into a lot of discussion about what Section 10 is intended to do or not intended to do. Like, to try to be responsive to you, I would say that I think there's an understanding that the Federal COBRA Act requires all hospitals to accept and treat persons in emergency situations. There may be disagreements about outside those clinical situations what flexibility, if any, does a hospital have relative to the acceptance for treatment. And I think more discussion is going to have to go on in that area.
I can predict it's going to be very difficult to get any number of transplant services available at any of the hospitals for Oregon Health Plan patients, because while a hospital might need to take them on an emergency basis, it doesn't necessarily need to provide a kidney transplant.
Well, part of that gets into, I mean, here's his primary care position, you know, where is that position at privileges, you know, what's the contractual relationship between, you know, the member of the fully capped plan and the hospital in the local area. I think there are ways to get at that with enough specificity to avoid, you know, any of those type issues, at which we must do.
They're looming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you again, Barney.
Thanks.
Without further ado, let me call up Mr. Gallant. He may have an opinion or two on medical malpractice environment.
Isn't that Dr. Gallant yet? Yeah. I mean, hasn't he hung out with those guys long enough so he gets the honorary degree?
He actually allowed in Representative Cruz's committee the other day that he has not had a physical in, let me be accurate, how long?
About a decade, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, well, smokers don't like to go into physicians.
Actually, the last physical I did have would amaze you on how healthy I am.
Yeah, I would.
And we did the I won't go into that.
There is a, I believe, statutory requirement for professional advocates to tell the truth, Mr. Gallant. So
that's right.
We don't want
and full disclosure.
Yeah, we don't want to start off.
However, Mr. Chairman, I can fairly say that I have not reconfirmed the reports from a decade ago when I did have.
Nor did you get a second opinion when they were first rendered. Yeah,
that's a good way to do it.
A psychiatric evaluation was not included, so I can't address that either.
Some of us who are more generously proportioned than you don't have a lot of room to talk either.
I think he's aiming that at me, Scott, not at you.
And me.
I've been to a doctor much more recently than that.
Mr. Gallant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, and I've already been asked by one person in the audience, what does liability have to do with this particular bill. Actually, I have two reports, and the reason I asked your staff to kind of include the issue of practice environment is that I've also submitted a secondary report that was just released to our House of Delegates, which is a biennial meeting of physicians throughout the state. That was a survey of all physicians in a variety of areas, including liability issues, access, whether physicians accept Medicare patients, Medicaid patients, how long it takes to see established patients or new patients, et cetera. And I'll get into some of those issues in that survey as well. I'll try to keep this short and brief. It is, in fact, a lot of information for you. Some of it is quite, obviously, quite new. The liability climate in Oregon, which should not come as any surprise to any of you, is in a serious state. We were one of the original 12 states listed by the AMA as a state in crisis over liability costs. That list has been expanded to 18 states. So far, we're also listed as a essentially a crisis state by the National College of OBs, and we're also proudly listed as a state in trouble in the area of neurosurgery by also a national society at the federal level. So we have managed to extend our new character of Oregon and how we're doing things into this area as well. The facts as we believe them to be, and I think they're actually quite accurate, since it's OMA data through our insured CNA Insurance and Northwest Physicians Mutual as well, indicates that the amount of money that is being expended since the Supreme Court overturned a limit on non-economic damages of $500,000 have gone up precipitously since that was ruled unconstitutional. As a matter of fact, you'll see in the data on Oregon's experience the actual frequency, in other words, the number of paid claims, has decreased 46% over a 20-year period, but the amount of payments has gone up over 367% on the average claim payment, which is well above and beyond the rate of inflation, whether you use the CPI medical index, Portland, Salem, or the non-inflationary index as well. Since the Lakin decision in just a few years ago, 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, there's been a 65% increase in payments since that decision, a substantial problem for Oregon physicians. I've also provided a chart of premiums, again, going back.
Scott, Mr. Chair, may I ask you a question on these tables?
You may
tables,
ask
please?
Any question you like.
Let me get the page. There's a post-Lakin, how do the losses stack up, and it says in July through December of 99, there were four claims for $285,000, that page. And then...
$2,850,000.
I'm sorry, 2.8.
Yeah, could you explain...
Four claims.
Which, I'm sorry.
Okay, this one...
Third page in.
Oh, okay.
This one says four claims.
Could
and
you
then,
explain that chart?
Yeah, these are...
And also, how does that compare to the blue one, which said there were 78...
These are large claims since the Lakin decision, essentially. And payments, total payments for those claims, and how they have occurred since the Lakin decision. Historically, to put it in context, my recollection was that when I lobbied on the tort reform bill that was adopted in 1987, as the chairman of the coalition at that time, Oregon had had maybe $2 or $3 million awards prior to that time. We are now, for example, from April to April, a year from last April to this April, we've had 14 jury awards or settlements that are what we consider to be large claim payments, which is over a payment of over $500,000. And the total average paid claim for those 14 cases is now over $1 million for large claims, which is a substantial jump of what the average claims were prior to the Lakin decision. The chart, the blue chart on trends on paid claim counts and average payments on physicians only tells you a couple of things, which is that the number of actual paid claims, jury awards, in other words, jury awards or settlements, has essentially declined after the tort reform measures were adopted in 1987, including a limit on non-economic damages, and stayed flat for more than a decade until the Supreme Court overturned the limit on non-economic damages.
You read those X's against the right bar, right?
Correct.
Against the right thing, and
that is correct.
And the bars against the left one.
Correct. So essentially what this picture is showing you is that it's not the frequency of paid claims and settlements that's having an impact on the overall cost of premiums or expenditures. It's the size of the average paid claims, which has gone up significantly over the last 3 or 4 years, that is having such a dramatic impact. That's the point of that chart. And then we essentially show you what the indemnity paid, yearly average indemnity paid, again, over a 20-year period. Again, you see it corresponding to the amounts of monies being paid out, and they go up at a more rapid pace as the size of the awards go out. And you'll see what happened historically on the next chart of paid premiums and increases and decreases. And the purpose of this chart, and this shows you two different companies, the OMA-sponsored program, CNA, rates, and Northwest Physicians Mutual, which is a physician-owned and operated company based out of Salem, Oregon. Prior to the 1987 reforms, what was occurring during that crisis, which was in fact both a frequency and a payment amount of money going out a problem, and then what occurred after the reforms were adopted and what happened to premiums, average premiums over that period of time. Again, just to illustrate, since the 99 decision, the physicians' premiums have more than doubled in the last 4 years, which is having the effect of tremendous pressures on physicians, being able to get coverage, get an adequate amount of coverage, and the impact it's having on their practices. And the survey that I'll get into in a minute goes into some of that and some other detail about the ordering of additional tests, the referral of complex cases where it is possible, and that's having a great impact on patient access to care. The next chart, again, is just to illustrate, and this is the chart that says essentially what the impact has been in specialty areas. And I'm trying to show here that this is not a problem that is just associated with obstetrics. It's much broader than that. And you can see that the average claim payments, not including defense costs, have gone up significantly in Oregon for a variety of specialties by our Oregon data, everywhere from a 79% increase from orthopedic surgery, unfortunately, to a 256% increase for OB-GYN, and a significant increase for neurology and neurosurgery. The next chart is, and these are just for pending claims in Oregon for CNA-insured physicians. There's almost a billion dollars in demands for claims that have been filed to date, for an average demand of over $3.3 million out of 255 claims. We clearly don't have the capacity to meet that kind of demand. That's not actually what will happen before it gets said and done. Approximately 70% of all claims that are originally filed go away, and we're, or 80%, and we're about 60% successful, they could go to court and usually settle a portion of those claims as well. So we're talking about a very small percentage of settlements and jury awards that are driving the cost of liability premiums in this state. And I'm not going to get into any great detail on the next few charts. It's about defense costs, et cetera, but they do have an impact. We spend about, for CNA, about $5 million a year, essentially on claims that get dropped and never go anywhere, which is unfortunate, but that is the nature of the system. And we track that for you, again, over a historical period of time. And we also provide for you a estimated breakout of where the funds go for a settlement or jury award in the process, again, historically, over a long period of time. There have been those who have suggested that the problem is really an insurance problem. We have, the Medical Association has really attempted to try to find that in Oregon as being the culprit for the rapid increase in medical malpractice premium costs in the state. It appears, at least from our research and data, that the reason for the rapid increase in liability premiums is, in fact, because we are expending more in settlements and judgments than we're collecting in premiums, and more than insurers are able to get in returns on the money that they invest in the state. In regard to, I'd like to move, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you, to the next set of the next report, which is our workforce assessment
Scott,
report.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask a question before that? What's the I've heard some discussion from lawyers, not trial lawyers, but lawyers who talk about their liability, their own liability coverage, and their essentially community rating among lawyers, their malpractice coverage, and wondering why physicians insist on sort of experience, it isn't exactly experience rating, but rating by class rather than by community rating across all physicians, is it? And I know that the OMA has been particularly opposed to that model. Is there, could you just discuss
Mr. Chairman,
that a little bit?
The Attorney's Professional Liability Fund has a base limit that we would love to have. I believe it's $300,000. They do provide some excess coverage. It's not, I don't think, a big portion of their book of business. They also roll in attorneys' costs, defense attorney costs, within the limits of the state fund itself and medical malpractice commercial markets today. We don't do that.
I understand that,
but if you would, but in reality, you have a physician-owned and operated nonprofit liability company in Oregon, in Salem. That is, you know, you can make the parallel. It's essentially a PLF type model. Their premiums and their rates and their expenditures are essentially paralleling our sponsored program over the course, a historical course of time.
But if I may follow up, the issue isn't, yes, I mean, I understand that you both charge obstetricians the same amount, and you both charge neurosurgeons roughly the same amount. The question is there any possibility of averaging those rates by pooling them across all physicians rather than by rating them by the specific specialty of
the Mr. Chairman, the impact of that is to have those in lower risk practices, family practice, or others, to essentially subsidize high risk specialties.
That's right. The assumption would be you can't practice as a family physician unless you have backup in neurosurgery, unless you have backup in orthopedic surgery, and that one of the costs of doing business in order to have all that backup is to make sure they're there for your patients and to amortize that cost across a larger pool, because there are very much smaller number of neurosurgeons than there are primary care doctors, for example.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I didn't understand your point, or let me try it another way. In order to do the PLF model, which is based on all attorneys paying the same rate regardless of their type of practice, you would try to do that across all physicians,
right,
to make it work. The PLF model for attorneys, I think most attorneys, plaintiffs, or otherwise would agree that you don't have non-economic damage awards typically in legal malpractice.
Yeah, but if you did, maybe you would double the rates across all of them. But it would be doubled evenly.
The other issue is, fundamental issue is, the PLF model does not address the fundamental problem that we believe exists, which is you are expending substantially greater amounts of money than the premium you're getting from physicians. And so it doesn't fundamentally address the problem at hand. What it would do is substantially increase the cost of having low-risk physicians, subsidizing physicians who practice in high-risk specialties, which include orthopedics, neurosurgery, cardiac surgeons, trauma surgeons, a wide variety of very specialized high-risk sorts of practice. And so I believe, and I would say, I think I'm on safe ground, that physicians in low-risk practices are not enamored by the idea of subsidizing high-risk specialists for awards that are well in excess at times in Oregon of their coverage. The other issue that was raised in testimony in front of the House Judiciary Committee was what it would cost to administer a PLF-type model for under the Board of Medical Examiners. This bill, of course, has been introduced at the request of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
All right.
So I'm glad to hear other defense attorneys are talking about it, too. The estimated cost for the administration of it is, according to the BME, $21 million, which is a fairly substantial amount of money. The other issue I would also mention in regard to the PLF is that they have had to, as a matter of fact, twice increase their premiums due to their recent losses and on their low rate of return on their investments. As I understand it, the PLF invests more in the stock market than do Northwest Physicians Mutual or CNA, and so they're having to make up for that. They also have a much higher administration cost under that plan than the administration costs under both Northwest Physicians Mutual and CNA. So other than that, and not really addressing the underlying problem, at least as we see it, it is an issue that keeps coming up and seems to have some mystery about being a simple solution for a complex problem.
Well, it's that simple, and it's the same argument that I have on community rating health insurance versus experience rating. I mean, it is a social model, and this is not about the trial lawyers. I've heard more about it from Representative Richardson, for example, and others who are
I understand
Representative Richardson's professional practice.
Well, I don't.
Something you might want to check into.
Any other questions for Mr. Gallant?
If I could try to briefly highlight some things from the statewide survey, Mr. Chairman, I apologize.
In a fairly expeditious fashion, if you would. We can have you back.
Let me get to a couple of particularly what I think are important points, since your issue area as well is Medicaid. Our survey on page, I don't know if they're numbered.
They are.
Page 7. Top left corner is where page numbers are. You will see an outline of the number of physicians. This is this document.
No, it's not that one. It's this one. You can't have mine.
You each have one of these. It is this document, yeah. Page 7.
Well,
don't give one to Cruz.
Westland always steals my stuff.
You will see the
percentage
of physicians who no longer accept or who limit the number of Medicaid patients that they see. These numbers, in our view, are very, very troubling and are, at least for in my technical terminology, huge, which is why I have alluded, I think, to some of you privately. That the number of participating physicians in the Medicaid program is dropping like a rock or a missile that has a guidance system. And I think the quote on that page is probably indicative of why that is the case. OHP provides well below the cost of providing care. It asks physicians to provide essentially free care under the guise of a governmental coverage program. Like a lot of people say, I guess, in observing human behavior, when you see people voting with their feet, you've got a problem. And it's not just a small problem. This is a widespread problem throughout the state of Oregon.
May I ask a question on the state of Montessori?
Representative Green.
Does this say 60% restricted it in 2000, but only 20%? I mean in 2002, but only 20% in 2003?
What this chart is showing is what has happened historically on the number of physicians who are not providing or are limiting their services to Medicaid patients. And as you will recall, well, we're barely into 2003, so that number could get worse. But what this is essentially showing is that because the plan is, I think, in part such a bad payer for services, that they are withdrawing or not providing their services for these clients because they cannot afford to do so. They cannot shift those losses to Medicare, which is, as you know, not all that great at reimbursement, and they have difficulty shifting those losses to commercial insurers as well.
But doesn't this chart say 40%? Only 40% were accepting it in 2002, but 80% are accepting Medicaid in 2003?
The number of physicians who indicated when they either decided to not see any Medicaid patients or limit the number of Medicaid patients that they would see. Is the purpose of that chart. We asked on the questionnaire, when did you decide to either limit or not see Medicaid patients?
The universe of this are the ones who are not seeing them.
Right.
And this talks about what year. This isn't the proportion of total doctors.
Correct. The part at the top is the percentage of physicians who no longer see or significantly limit seeing Medicaid patients. The bottom chart shows you when they made those decisions over a historical period of time. These are really big, troubling numbers. I also provide you a list. This also shows you on the next page how long it takes to see established and non-established patients. Some of these numbers, again, are incredible. If you use gastroenterology, it's for a new patient, non-urgent patient, over 50 days. And some of these are like a month. I mean, these are indicators that we have significant problems in the medical community of having patients have access to physicians.
This actually looks an awful lot like the time frame I would get if I called my doctor.
It is very difficult, and my point is that I believe if the private discussions among physicians is that we are having great difficulty in retaining and or recruiting physicians here, and I believe to a large degree it's because of a combination of things: liability climate, reimbursement rates in this state, and it is causing a short-term and will continue to be a big-time, longer-term problem for all Oregonians.
Representative Mark.
Yeah, Scott, I back on your page 7, I mean, we're talking about 1 in 5 physicians do not currently accept the Oregon Health Plan, all right? Mm-hmm. Well, 1 in 4 don't accept workers' compensation either. So they just don't like the paperwork? So they don't like the paperwork for workman's comp. I can't expect them liking the paperwork for this either. Is it the same physicians?
There is later on in this a list of what the priority concerns are with physicians of having an impact on them, et cetera, but it's later in the report. It is clear, at least from the initial data that I've seen, that physicians, particularly for Medicaid patients, it's a combination of things. It's reimbursement, their inability to shift losses for seeing those patients, a Medicaid patient every time they see them, the paperwork structure, the regulatory framework, a great variety of things. And actually, overall, the biggest concern, about 7 or 8 years ago, we had 96% physician participation in the Oregon Health Plan. Of practicing physicians, you are seeing in front of you, physicians just walking away from it, which is very, very unfortunate from our perspective.
Why are they walking workers away from comp,
workers' comp? One is kind of a unique structure. The payment is much better under workers' comp. It is a very arcane system. Highly regulated. Physicians are required to do extensive reports. Some physicians would suggest that miserable payment for their time in service. They're often asked to have to take time to testify in regard to their cases. You have to get second opinions. It is a very complicated structure.
How much of the overlap of the ones that don't take workers' comp also don't take? And I know you probably don't
Mr.
have that.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't. I'm sorry.
I'd be happy to look at your database.
Yeah, Steve and I could do it together.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The only other two, I'll try to hit two other points that I think are particularly troublesome, if I can find it now. One is in the area of what are physicians doing in response to liability and what kind of impact, obviously I think you can make those conclusions on your own, what kind of impact that has on costs, whether it's Medicaid or otherwise. 20% of the physicians on page 14, 20% of physicians have already increased diagnostic procedures or plan to do so. In other words, In the vernacular, I would say they are trying to cover themselves in case there's an allegation of liability. We also have a percentage of physicians who have already closed their practices, plan to do so. But if you look on the next page, if you look down on lines 26 to 27 on the next page, about one in five physicians under the age of 49 will consider relocating their practice. And that's under the age of 40, 20%. Physicians between 40 and 49, 18%. Again, our concern is that the practice environment in this state may very well be providing an incentive for the very future core medical community to relocate in other areas of the country where they believe the practice environment is significantly better than Oregon. We've also, the following page, page 16, one in five physicians, 22.3% of increased referral of complex cases definitely will do so. There's some breakout of that by region, and some data on potential retirement data as well. I believe, all in all, that the combination of these two reports is very, very troubling. And I hope at some point in the near future that the legislature will take the time and resources to try to, in a more comprehensive way, try to address this, or otherwise I think we are all in serious trouble in getting access to needed and appropriate care, including very complex care. Thank you.
What do you make of the comment on the last?
Representative Green.
Sir, what do you make of the comment on the last page that says, basically, I love my practice. I doubt if I'd go into medicine again.
I'm sorry, what?
There's a quote on the last page that says, basically, I love my practice. I doubt if I'd go into medicine again.
It's not as much fun.
I love their practice.
It's among other things.
I very much enjoy my practice.
Yeah, and I don't think I'd go into it again since I enjoy it so much. Yeah.
Well, most physicians will tell you that they love working with patients, seeing patients, treating patients, doing what they're trained to do. They hate the practice environment that they find themselves in. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. You might want to put on the record just the respondent numbers to your survey.
Mr. Chairman, that is in fact in the front of the report. It's approximately half of practicing physicians in the state of Oregon, but that is in the beginning of the report. Thank you.
10,000.
Thank you, Scott. We are going to alter the agenda a little bit as I look out at Mr. Earls. I see his hair has turned a whiter shade of pale, even as we...
Wasn't that a good song?
It was an excellent song. We'll call harem.
Yep.
Even as we sit here. So we will definitely have you back. We appreciate the considerateness of your offer.
Mr. Chair, how he could...
Representative Greenlick just wishes he had hair to turn a whiter shade of pale, but...
You betcha. I mean, that's the way I looked when I started this session.
Anyway, so see, no other business come before the committee. We are adjourned. Thank you, Kevin.